This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. May has got to be one of the most exciting months in Vermont. We go from pretty much bare branches and only the earliest of spring flowers to a veritable explosion of green in one single month. And on this last day of May, it's a great time to talk about what's happening in the garden at this point and how you can set yourself up for the best summer harvest ever. Here to help us do that is gardening expert and VPR's Vermont Garden Journal host, Charlie Nardozzi. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Jane.
Nice to see you and always fun to talk gardens with you. So I want to know what's going on in your garden because my garden is sort of a non-starter this year. So tell me about yours and I can live vicariously.
We'll talk about my garden.
Great.
Yes. So it's been kind of an odd season because it was kind of a mild winter and then it got this cold snap in April or so where the temperatures really dipped down and even into early May and things like asparagus got nipped by frost, for example, and daffodils. So we got some really cold temperatures there for a while. And then after a while, it started warming up again, and things really kind of burst onto the scene. And just like you're saying, I'm always amazed. It literally, it wasn't a month. It seemed like a couple of days. We went from bare branches to full-on green flowers, everything just exploding in color. So after this very warm spell that we had over Memorial Day, it's really kind of burst onto the scene, and everything is just growing and seemed to be popping out of the ground.
So do you have everything in your garden now outside that you're planning to plant? I mean, with the caveat that some things you plant late season, you know, some things
are already
harvesting, but anything that, like tomatoes, things that you maybe started as seedlings indoors or that some people may be buying from their local garden store, is that all out and in the garden now?
Yeah, so the traditional planting day in Vermont for most of Vermont is around Memorial Day. So yes, you should pretty much have everything planted into the garden by now. Annuals, perennials, vegetables. Certainly you can continue to plant perennials, trees, and shrubs as the season goes along. There are a few things you might want to even wait a little longer on because even though it did get really hot, that was kind of a new thing that came along. It was cold pretty much up until that point when we hit 90 degrees over the last weekend. So things like sweet potatoes, melons, okras, you know, those really hot, loving greens and vegetables, those you can put in. You know, it's okay to wait until early June. And in fact, if you're sitting there thinking, oh, a garden, I hadn't thought about that. I could do that. There's still plenty of time to garden. And you can be planting, for example, I often will succession plant beans, bush beans, right till the end of July. So you can be planting a lot of these crops into June and early July and still getting a nice harvest by the late summer and fall.
So basically, procrastinators need not feel like they're out of it.
If you look around and see your friends are gardening, you know, your relatives are gardening, everybody's gardening except for you, it's not too late to get involved and have some fun.
We're talking today about gardens and gardening with Charlie Nardozzi, our favorite gardening expert, and he's here today talking to us about how to make the most out of your garden. If you have a question for Charlie, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can always post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Or hey, tweet us at Vermont Edition. We got a question from Dale who says, I have dry white spots and edges on some of my broccoli seedlings. I started them in new peat pots with fresh potting soil. After researching, it seems to be white spot fungus. Will it infect my other seedlings? Is it worth treating?
So if you get these white spots on the broccoli seedlings, right, that was on there, it could potentially spread to any of the other broccoli family plants if it is, in fact, this white spot fungus. But as if you have a nice spacing between the plants so the water, so air can flow around them pretty well, that's going to dry them out. A lot of these fungus need some moisture to really get going. So often with broccoli, you'll see that they'll grow so fast they can outgrow a fungus like this. So I would just keep an eye on it, maybe even snip off some of those leaves if the seedling's big enough to support snipping off a few leaves. Taking a few of those off that are most heavily damaged, leave the rest of them on there. Give it a shot of fish emulsion. Fish emulsion is a great high nitrogen fertilizer, very soluble nitrogen fertilizer, and it also can help a little bit with disease too. So give it a shot of fish emulsion, try to really boost it along, and just kind of watch it. And if in a week or two it seems like it's not getting better, it actually is spreading a little bit, then you might have to resort to some kind of fungicide to slow it down.
Okay, what, any fungicide that you recommend?
Well, I usually do everything organic, so I tend to go in that direction with all of the recommendations. And Serenade is a bacteria that fights a fungus. It's kind of a new biocontrol thing that's out there. There's a number of different products, but that one, Serenade in particular, works very well for the wide range of fungi.
But you mentioned that one of the things that could sort of help this fungus continue is if you have things that are planted too close together. So you,
right.
This is why, you know, we often talk about spacing. And if you're somebody who plants from seed and it says, you know, plant so many and then you want to pull the weaker one so you have them 4 to 6 inches apart, you know, sometimes I think, oh, but come on, I could squeeze a few more in because really, what's the difference? And then sometimes they're so far spaced apart, you think you get to the end of the season and you think, I could have fit like 3 or 4 more plants in there.
I got hardly anything at all.
Right,
yes. But there are some other reasons, as we're talking about, that you want to space the plants properly. And this is one of them. When you have plants closely grouped together, a lot more moisture hangs onto the leaves that might occur overnight because we still get kind of those dewy mornings because the nights are a little cooler than the days. So that moisture that's sitting there overnight on those leaves is a perfect opportunity for a lot of fungi to get going. So if you can space them a little further apart, if you have that issue in your garden, the other thing you can do, of course, is if you have a number of raised beds or a number of different locations, is to move things around. Rotate crops, put crops in different places where if they have in the past gotten leaf diseases, maybe put them in a windier, more exposed spot so they'll dry out faster, they get more air circulation around them, and you'll have less likelihood of getting the disease.
Is it always good to move things around if you can anyway, just to...
Yes, that's generally true with a vegetable garden. You want to do a what they call a 3-year rotation. So you don't want to plant the same family of crops in any one bed for 3 years. And so you do need to know who's in what family, who's related.
Right.
So the potatoes, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, that's one family, for example. The broccoli, the cabbage, the cauliflower, kale, Brussels sprouts, that's another family. So doing a little research, you can figure out who belongs to what family and just try to rotate those around every year.
Yeah, good advice, except if you have this system and you like to see your tomatoes in one spot every year, you always are going to think of tomatoes there.
Or if you have a small garden and you don't have the room to rotate, then adding some compost and being observant, that's probably the best thing.
All right. Again, if you have a question for Charlie, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note, post a photo if you want of your garden, what it looks like now, or maybe just your favorite picture of your garden from years past, something that you look at all winter and something that you aspire to every spring. You can do that on our Facebook page. You can find Vermont Edition. Let's go to Ellen, who's calling in from Lebanon. Hi, Ellen. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Yes, my question is about okra. What needs does it have as far as soil and water go?
So we're not talking emotional needs. We're talking soil and water.
Soil and water. Basic needs. Yes, so okra is one of those crops I was just talking about, loves the heat. Now think of okra, think of the South, a lot of humidity, a lot of heat. So there's no need to rush it into the garden. And she's calling from Lebanon, New Hampshire?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you're down there, certainly this week, next week, you probably plant okay because the soil's warmed up enough, especially if you have a full sun location. As far as the kind of soil, anything that's well-drained, more on the sandier side would be ideal for that. Again, because it warms up fast, the roots can go deep into the soil and it'll quickly grow. If you have a heavy clay soil, you might consider raising up that bed so that it'll drain out, warm up a little bit faster, amending it heavily with organic matter and compost. And as far as watering goes, it's really just like any of the other vegetables. It will take a lot of water, but just kind of keep on top of it. Remember that any of these really warm season crops, especially from the South, grow fast because they have to. We only have a certain amount of days here that'll stay long enough, sun's out there long enough, the heat is high enough for them to really get the growth they need. So you have to stay on top of it. If we have a spell of 3 or 4 days and it hasn't rained, go out there and do a nice deep soaking. Okra tends to have more of a taproot, so the deeper you can soak that soil deep down into the soil, the taproot will go down and stay down there. And then when it dries out, it'll be deep enough to mine the water that's in the soil too.
We have a note from Fran in Weybridge who says, what do you recommend for a mulch for my perennial flower and shrub beds? I had been using bark mulch, but I've been hearing that it's not the best way to go. I already use compost as an amendment. I'm interested in weed suppression, keeping the soil moist, and making the beds look attractive.
Yeah, so bark mulch is fine. There's lots of different types of it out there. There's shredded bark mulch, there's bark nuggets, there's bark chips, there's all kinds of bark that you can get. You can go to these garden centers that sell it in bulk, and they literally have big vats of mulch that could be black forest mulch and red mulch, colored mulch that's out there for those who want to do something a little more exotic. So I think
You mean like the, like blue mulch? Like
yes. Well, not around. You don't see that so much in Vermont. You go further south, not to pick on the south again. If you go to the south, you'll often see blue mulches, yellow mulches, bright orange mulches. Sometimes they match them with the school colors for the local university, whatever it is. So, yes, there's a whole reason behind it. It's a decorative type of thing.
Got it.
You don't see that so much in Vermont. We're kind of a little more on the natural side as far as the natural colors.
Reserved.
But reserved. Exactly. Reserved. But there's nothing wrong with bark mulch, and I like to use it because it does break down and add to the organic matter. So I'm not sure why she's trying to get away from using bark mulch. There's really, as far as I can understand, not a lot of downside of it. You can get certain kinds of fungus if you have a lot of it on there and it's really wet summer. There's one fungus in particular called the artillery fungus. Artillery, you know, like the guns, because literally when the fungus comes out of the ground, it'll shoot like black spores and it can get on your house and stain it. It's kind of a wild thing, but that's how fungus is.
Yeah, we could do a whole show on
fungus. We could do a whole show on fungus. It's fascinating stuff.
That would be very public radio, Charlie.
Yeah, very much so.
So Fran should stick with the bark mulch.
So I would stick with the bark mulch, unless there's some personal aversion to it. You don't like the look of it. And then if you don't, you can go with straw. That's a nice material. It doesn't have weed in it. Stay away from hay because it has weed seeds in it. But straw will not have that. You can chop up leaves. You can even chop up your grass clippings as long as you don't treat your lawns with any chemicals, and use that as a mulch too. So there's a lot of organic materials that you can use. And if you really don't like organic materials at all and you want to go a little kind of contemporary nouveau, you can get stone and mulch with stone. So that's another option.
Or glass. Can you get those little crushed marble
yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. The colored glass. That's another southern thing.
That's right. And yeah, if you want to go not reserved at all.
You can put that next to your bottle tree. You ever seen those?
Yes, I have.
And the bone fences?
I haven't seen the bone fences.
Okay.
We can do a field trip next time.
Yes, we can. We should. From the road.
Brian in Jericho says, hey, Charlie, do you need any more rabbits down your way? We could supply you with some. Is there any chemical rabbit repellent that works as well as a fence or a rifle?
Or a nice healthy crop of bobcats around or something like that. That's really, I'm in Ferrisburg. And so that's really, I think, what kind of keeps our rabbits in check. We see them around, but we also see some of the predators around too. But as far as repelling them, if you don't have the natural predators, there's a lot of things that they will sell you. Everything, kind of like the same thing with deer. It'd be rotten eggs. It could be slaughterhouse waste. It could be animal urine, predator urines. It could be cayenne pepper, garlic, all these things. They will all work to a certain degree for a certain period of time, and then the animal gets used to it, or it rains and washes it off, and then they come through. So I usually tell people, if you really have a problem with rabbits, use a fence. And they're pretty easy to keep out with a fence as long as you make sure that the fence holes are not too big, because the little baby bunnies can sneak right through. Mm-hmm. I had that happen in our garden last year, where he snuck in, and then he spent the summer in our garden because he couldn't get out because he grew bigger than the hole.
And did you ever catch him and get him out?
We never caught him. I saw him running around, and I'd see some damage here and there. Eventually, I think he got out through the gate, but I hope. I don't know. I never saw him again. But they're very tricky, as they say. So yes, use a nice fence that go down into the soil. Dig it into the soil a little bit, because they can dig underneath the fence, and make it up. It can only be about 2 or 3 feet tall, unless you have really big rabbits where you are.
Yeah, or if you're trying to also keep the deer out.
Yes, the deer or woodchucks out. Then you might want to go a little bit higher. But that would probably be the best solution, is use a fence.
Okay. All right. So sorry, Brian, you're going to have to go with a fence. Or maybe you can get those fake owls and see how they go.
I've seen the birds sitting on the fake owls looking
but
around.
But maybe the rabbits are more scared of them.
I don't know about that.
Let's go to Stephen calling in from Manchester. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my question. I have a number of transplants started, both vegetable and flowers, perennials, annuals, and I've noticed that a number of my flowering plants have been dropping flowers within a week after transplant. And I'm wondering if that's a function of too much watering. I guess that leads me to my big question, and that's, how much watering is too much watering?
Yes. Well, too much watering would mean that the plants are starting to wilt over. You get a disease called damping off, where the actual stem kind of rots right at the soil line. That's all signs that you're watering too much. What might be happening with your plants, though, Stephen, is that when you're putting them out, if you're not hardening them off properly, they're going to go through transplant shock, especially if you did any transplanting over the weekend when it was really hot. And that means that they've gone through this nice, comfortable indoor environment, whether it be in a cold frame greenhouse or indoors, right out to the wind and the sun and the heat and everything, and they can't really do all of that. And plus, when you're moving them from a pot into the soil, those roots are going to get damaged. So you're going to have less water coming up into the plant to support the leaves and flowers. So my suggestion would be is to harden them off, and you can do that over a period of 5 to 7 days, just gradually moving them out, then back in, and longer each day. And the other thing is that when you transplant them out, snip off the flower buds. I know that might kill you to do that, but it's a good thing to do in the long run. Even things for vegetables like peppers, for example, if you have small pepper plants with flowers on them, snip those off, because you want the plant to send all its energy into forming a good, strong root system, good form top growth, so that later on, the next flush of flowers, they'll be able to support them and keep producing all summer long.
Oh, yeah, that would be a hard thing to
do,
though.
It's like thinning. No one wants to do it, but you really should.
All right, fine. Emily's calling in from Plainfield. Hi, Emily. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Jane. Charlie, my question is if you have looked at the Back to Eden gardening method, which is a no-till method using wood chips, where the wood chips hold the funguses that restore the soil over years to an awesome black dirt, and then you plant directly under the first layer of the wood chips. And something about the whole makeup of wood chips is so restorative to the soil, and then you don't add anything, no additives to the soil except for maybe chicken poop on top. Are you familiar with that Back to Eden method? I see that it's just giving wonderful results.
Yeah, I've heard of a similar method, and maybe it is the same one, just using a different name, called Hügelkultur, which is a German term meaning that you're growing plants in a mound of wood. If you think of stems and old trees and old branches, you kind of either create a swale or a ditch, you bury them in there, and then you put soil on top of them, and you slowly let it break down. Or you can build it up as a raised bed and do it in that way. But I've heard people having great results with that. It sounds like a very similar kind of idea, in that you're creating a strong fungal environment in the raised bed, so that it slowly breaks down, slowly releases those nutrients, and plants that you put in the top in that soil that's covering it will be able to really tap into that and grow well.
We're talking about gardens today. We're talking with Charlie Nardozzi, host of the Vermont Garden Journal on VPR, a gardening guru, a gardening consultant. If you have a question for him, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Earlier this year, people interested in learning about some of the threats to our local pollinators, think bees, butterflies, joined together for a summit in Burlington. And one of the interesting things that came out of the summit was about how much habitat pollinators need to thrive. Joining us now with an update is Leif Richardson. He's an ecologist with the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics at UVM, and he specializes in bees, their parasites, and the plants they pollinate. Hi, Leif. Nice to talk with you again.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And I understand we caught you out in the field. Where are you at the moment?
Yes, I'm studying blueberry pollinators at the moment, so I'm at a farm in Charlotte, watching bees go from flower to flower.
What are you doing in terms of looking at how they pollinate blueberries? What's the connection that's important to pay attention to there?
Well, blueberry is a crop that requires pollination by bees, and without bees, we really don't get very many berries off of blueberry, so farmers typically bring honeybees to farms to increase the number of bees that visit flowers. But there are also a lot of wild bees that visit blueberry plants. And with colleagues and collaborators, I'm studying the way that wild bees come to farms to forage for their food, and in so doing, transfer pollen between flowers and pollinate blueberry. And so we get this economic return from this ecosystem service of pollination.
Huh. Leif, are our pollinators, our native pollinators in Vermont, by and large, doing okay? I mean, I understand different ones are facing different threats, but generally speaking, what's the landscape?
Well, it's difficult to say for all of them how they're doing, because many of them are insects, and we just lack information about about the status of most of those insects. So the most important group of pollinators here is bees, and then probably followed up by flies and butterflies and moths. So for a few species, we have a lot of information about where they used to occur, where they do now occur, how many bees there are in different places. But for most, we just don't know. And so what we do know is that a number of individual species are in decline, but then many others are probably doing well. The ones in decline tend to be special cases like the monarch butterfly, where there's a question of what happens on their wintering ground or during the migration north and south, or large-bodied bees like bumblebees, and specialist pollen forager bees that require just one type of plant to complete their reproduction.
So one of the things I mentioned coming out of this summit that was held just a couple months ago now in Burlington was about habitat for pollinators. And, you know, we often hear when we talk about animals and their needs and the threats to them that some animals have a need for large tracts of unbroken land and land that is connected, that's not, you know, subdivided by homes in various places. Is that true for pollinators, or can they actually survive with, I mean, maybe just a bunch of garden patches all over the place?
It depends on the species of pollinator, but in general, many of them are happy around around people where there are flowers. So bees and butterflies and many flies require nectar and or pollen to complete their life cycle. And so openings like fields and farms, the edges of woodlands, these are all places where there are more flowers than deep in the woods, and they tend to be good habitat for some of these animals. The forests that are the natural land cover for a lot of Vermont are also very important habitat for some other pollinators. But in those cases, they tend to specialize on a particular suite of plants that flower in the springtime. Maybe it's the trees that flower in spring, or the spring ephemeral wildflowers like trillium. Or they're specialists of something like goldenrod that might flower in the woods towards the end of summer.
So does it make sense for people? I mean, here we are in the middle of the garden show and people are thinking about how to plant, what to landscape. Does planting a pollinator garden do any good? Is that worthwhile to consider?
I think it's definitely worthwhile to consider. It is unclear just how much good it does for pollinators, but I think we can say it probably is doing some good for some species of native insects that are pollinators of both wild and cultivated plants, and so it's a good idea. There are a few caveats there. We don't always when we formulate a mix of plants for pollinator habitat, they're not always the most attractive plants to pollinators. They might be a mixture of things that are known to be good for pollinators, but also are showy and attractive to people. So some pollinator mixes, seed mixes, are definitely better than others for pollinators. There's also the question of whether we are planting non-native and weedy species when we plant pollinator habitat. And so that's a consideration that people should have. And I'll just add that there are some serious threats to bees and other pollinators that we do know about. One is loss of habitat, and that includes foraging habitat, flowers, but it includes some other things that won't be affected by planting pollinator habitat in your backyard. So things like parasites spread by commercial bees, climate change, other aspects of land use change. So I fully support. I think it's a great idea for people to plant for pollinators, but just to realize there are other threats that we need to think about also.
Leif Richardson is an ecologist with the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics at UVM. We'll let you get back to the blueberries and Charlotte. Leif, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
We are talking gardens today, and if you have a question about what to plant, when to harvest, how to cook, or just want to offer a suggestion, maybe on that score, what to cook with all of your bounty, call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Charlie Nardozzi is with us all hour. And Charlie, in terms of planting a pollinator garden, what do you recommend for specific plants?
Well, as Leif was saying, you do need to have pollen and nectar sources throughout the whole season. So that's the first thing you want to think about is what plants, what flowers can you put out there that'll be blooming from earliest early? You know, the bulbs, for example, are actually really helpful for a lot of the early bees and flies that are coming out, the scillas and the grape hyacinths and some of those early daffodils, those kinds of bulbs. Having some of those out there are really key nectar sources because there's not a lot else flowering at that season. But then having it a continuation throughout the spring into the summer. And I usually steer people towards native plants and also towards heirloom varieties. So these would be varieties that are not the exotic things. A great classic example is what's happened to Echinacea, the coneflower. It was called the purple coneflower, but it's hard to find the purple version anymore because there's yellow ones, there's orange ones, there's double ones, there's ones that don't even look like coneflowers. They're all very exotic. They're all very beautiful in the garden, but they're not as beneficial to a lot of these pollinating insects as the original purple coneflower. Flower or a white version, different species versions, because those insects don't recognize it sometimes, or it just doesn't have the same quality of pollen and nectar that they need. So stick with the original types of plants, whether it be coneflowers, rudbeckias, asters, you mentioned goldenrods, another nice one. Baptisia is a beautiful plant that's blooming in our garden right now. It's a nice one for a lot of these pollinating insects. And make sure you stagger them so you have color. And then, of course, introduce annuals too. A lot of the annuals and vegetables and herbs do really well with pollinating insects. We always grow extra fennel and dill. We let Queen Anne's lace grow up in the fields around us because any of those umbelliferous, is what they call them, flat-flowered types of weeds and vegetables and herbs are great for a lot of the pollinating insects, beneficial insects. And if you don't believe me, just watch what happens on top of a fennel plant that's flowered or a dill plant that's flowered on a hot summer day. It's just humming with activity because they just love it. And so having those kind of diversity of the type of plants, too, and keeping some wild plants in there are all really important.
So with your fennel and dill, you mean you plant some that you don't plan to harvest. You're
exactly.
Going to let it go to flower.
We just let it go to flower. So especially with the fennel. It's a beautiful flower, too. It has nice height to it. You know, I'm big into edible landscaping and foodscaping. So if you put some of those plants in amongst other flowers, they will kind of grow up. And then by midsummer, all of a sudden, bam, you've got this beautiful flower that's back there that's attracting beneficials, too.
Because otherwise, if you plan to eat your fennel and your dill, you don't want it to flower.
Yes, you're going to eat it before that, unless you're creating dill seed. Then letting it flower is fine, or fennel seed, for example. But if you're eating fennel like the Florence fennel for the bulb, no, you're going to be pulling that out and chopping it up and having some good saute.
Let's go to Dan calling in from Enosburg. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Charlie. I'm interested in your idea about the detrimental effects of some foot drenches, which are used in certain cow barns. They're formalin drenches. They contain formaldehyde, which is a neurotoxin, as well as atrazine, which goes out as a weed killer, I guess, and some corn crops.
Right. Yeah, certainly none of that you want to have near a garden or any kind of agronomic or any kind of commercial crops because, yes, it can it's toxic to the soil. It's toxic to the plants. And things like atrazine, for example, can last in the soil for a number of years. So it's very slow to kind of break down and be eliminated from the soil. So certainly if you have that issue if you're near a farm or on a farm and you're using those foot drenches for fungus on the feet of the cattle, definitely you have to get rid of those materials and dispose of them safely and not let them leach out into fields.
We have a note from Harvey who says, our Brussels sprouts were large and had beautiful foliage last year, but unfortunately minuscule sprouts. What happened and what can we do to improve things this year?
Well, Brussels sprouts, they do like a lot of nitrogen. Anything in that brassica family likes nitrogen, the cabbage, the broccoli, Brussels sprouts. But if you put too much nitrogen on them, you will get big, lush plants, big leaves, but the sprouts themselves will be just kind of small. And especially if you're, I don't know if he said where he was at and where he was located. If you're in a colder spot of Vermont, where you're going to get the sprouts are going to slow down their growth a little sooner than in the Champlain Valley or Connecticut River valleys. So what I would suggest next year or this year is to not put much nitrogen fertilizer. And when I say that, I include compost and composted manure because that is high in nitrogen, very accessible nitrogen. So don't put so much of that material on there. Let them grow. And if you see by early September, mid-September, nothing's happening, whack them, cut the tops off, and that's going to stimulate more energy to go form the sprouts and less to form the tops and the leafy growth.
Okay. Karen is in Rutland. Karen, you have a question for Charlie?
Yes. Thank you. Every year I grow zucchini and summer squash, and I've even moved it to different spots with fresh soil, and I always get that white worm in the base of the plants, and it kills them. Mm-hmm. And I understand it's a moth. So what I did this year is I bought little tents to put over them, and I'm not certain that's the answer.
Okay. Well, that is the answer, actually.
Woo-hoo.
Good job. It's the squash vine borer. So it does lay its egg right at the base of the plant near the soil line. The egg hatches, and you get that little worm that tunnels in there. It goes after zucchini, summer squash, melons, a number of different winter squash. There's a lot of different plants that it likes. And once it kind of finds your area, it'll find you no matter where you move your squash. So one of the great preventive techniques is exactly what you're talking about, putting some kind of tent, some kind of screening. You can use floating row cover, especially the really light grade floating row cover, as a physical barrier so it can't lay its egg. The downside of that, of course, is that with all these squashes, with most of the squashes, depending on the variety, you have to have cross-pollination. It says male and female flowers, and you have to have the bees cross-pollinate them to get the fruit. So if you have this tent over them and the bees can't get in, you're not going to get any fruit. So what you'll have to do is lift that tent off when they start flowering, allow them to come in, keep an eye out around that soil level to see if there's any kind of drilling and damage that's down there. And if you do see some signs of it, it's good to go in with a little clothes hanger or something that's into that hole and try to squish the little varmint before it causes much damage. The other option, of course, is to leave the tent on and do the pollination yourself. So you'd go out mid-morning, usually when both flowers are wide open. The male flower, of course, has no little fruit behind it, whereas the female has a little version of whatever you're growing behind the flower itself. Then you take a Q-tip, a cotton swab, you swish it in the male flower, you go over the female, you swish it in there, and hopefully you've pollinated. You can sit back and decide on names for the little baby.
Charlie, this is when I think if I really wanted to be a gardener, I'd just have to quit my job. Because if you're talking about going out with a Q-tip mid-morning, there's no way I can be working.
It's a good excuse for going home from work, right? I've got to go home and pollinate my squash.
Yeah, I don't think that one would work here. But maybe some other people can give it a shot.
Yes. Well, I'm giving you options. That's all.
We're talking with Charlie Nardozzi. More to come. Charlie has some breaking garden news for you. So don't leave us. We're going to talk about leek moths and Japanese beetles and some things, natural things that are eating Japanese beetles. Woohoo, mm-hmm. We're going to talk about that. And more of your questions, 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call. Sarah says, I'm wondering about ant colonies in the garden. This year, there's a large black ant colony in the middle of my community garden plot. The ants are small and black. Are the ants any harm to seeds and or seedlings?
Well, they will be harm only if you have that big mound and they're tunneling a lot down there and you're trying to plant around that mound, because their tunneling will create a lot of air spaces and the seeds won't have the necessary moisture a lot of times. And so they won't germinate and your plant may not grow very well. But the ants that we have around here in general are not going to go out. They're not like leaf cutter ants or something, where they're going to go out and actually start cutting down your plants. It's more that they're disturbing the soil. So if it's really bothering you, there's a lot of kind of home remedies people have used, everything from citrus peels to cinnamon to hot water that you put on the mound and try to drive them out.
Okay. And then Andrew says, I followed Charlie's fall advice in planting garlic in our raised beds. It's now about a foot tall, but I can't remember what variety I planted. Is there any way to tell by looking at it? And what do I do next?
Well, you will be able to tell what type of garlic, because it's hard neck or soft neck is the two general types. And the soft neck will not form the scapes. The hard neck will form scapes. So that will be happening, a few weeks or so, maybe towards the end of June. You'll start seeing the scapes will be forming. So if you have that, you have hard neck. If you don't have scapes, it's soft neck. Enjoy it. I'm glad it's growing well.
Yeah, and I love the scapes. I mean, I love to cook with the scapes, but also they just look so cool to have those curly cues in your gardens.
Yeah.
And then to be able to clip something before your garlic is ready to harvest. And
chop it up and it has that garlic flavor to it. It's really nice.
So, and you do want to clip them because you don't want them to flower either, right?
Yes. So you do, once they start doing the curly cue at that stage, clip them off, eat them, enjoy them, give them to your friends, whatever. But you want to get rid of them because they're, again, taking energy away from that bulb formation. So if you let them go to flower and everything, you may have a smaller size bulb with smaller cloves.
And I recommend either garlic scape pesto or garlic scape pickles. You can pickle them, and then they're beautiful in the jars.
Oh, like a fiddlehead kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I'm coming to your house.
Good. All right. So, Charlie, I mentioned that you have breaking garden news, and I mean, not quite breaking garlic news, but you have a couple things that you do want to talk about, and one is an update on the leek moth. What's happening with
it's actually a nice segue talking about garlic, because the leek moth is a relatively new pest that kind of came down through New York, jumped the lake, started in Chittenden County. Now,
maybe it took the ferry.
It might have taken the ferry, exactly. Maybe it was in someone's pesto. I don't know. Ooh. Anyway, so it is now in Vermont, and it's definitely been in the Champlain Valley for a number of years. It is spreading. I did talk with a researcher up at UVM, Vic Izzo, who's a PhD researcher up there, education specialist, and he kind of gave me the rundown of what's happening with leek moth because, you know, like anything, I wasn't really paying too much attention until it hit my garden. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, Vic, what's going on? So you got leek moth. So he said that they have stations out there where they're monitoring the populations. They've seen it all the way down to Rutland, all the way over into the Northeast Kingdom. And it is spreading around. And what it is it's a moth. So it's a nocturnal flying insect. And it lays an egg. It mostly likes leeks and garlic at a certain stage and onions. So those are kind of the things that it'll go after. But it definitely will devastate leeks. And if you're seeing your leeks like by midsummer, end of summer, looking like something that's chewed right through them, it's probably you have leek moth larvae in there.
Okay.
They also go after the hardneck garlics when those scapes form, just like you were saying. And they tunnel into the scapes and down into the bulb and cause a lot of damage there. And they'll go after the onions too. So because it's a night flying insect, though, you do have a couple really simple things that you can do to help keep your plants free from this kind of pest. And one is to cover them with a floating row cover, because anything in this family does not need cross-pollination, unlike the squash you were talking about. You can use that really light-grade floating row cover. Just cover your leeks, cover your garlic, and start with starting pretty soon, actually. He said there's three generations. The first one happens in May. Usually it's not too much of a problem, but the second and third generations in June, July, and then into August are ones that cause the most damage. And you would cover them if you don't want to cover them all day long. Again, if you have abundance of time, you can just cover them at night. So at the end of the evening, cover them up. That's when the moth is out laying eggs. In the morning, you can uncover them. The moth is not active then. And that would be a good way to kind of control those. So that's something you could do to try to reduce the problem. But if you're in southern Vermont or the southwest or southeastern Vermont, you know, you haven't seen this yet, keep an eye out for it.
It's coming.
It's coming. It definitely the damage is on the leeks. But if you see some damage on the onions and garlic, it might be that too.
All right. So that's kind of depressing news. But
yes,
you have some good news on predator to Japanese beetles, which is the scourge of so many gardens.
It's a scourge. You know, if this was the summer gardening show, we would be talking a lot about Japanese
beetles. We haven't even heard about red lily leaf beetles in this show, Charlie.
I know,
I feel like it's not even the garden
beetles
show.
What's going on out there?
You haven't mentioned beneficial nematodes once.
Well, let's talk about it now. So Japanese beetles, right now, they're cooking. They're percolating. They're just kind of making their way up through the soil levels, where eventually they're going to pupate towards the end of this month and then come out as the Japanese beetle adults. So long time ago, in fact, 100 years ago almost, this beetle's been around a long time, researchers went to Japan and found a parasitic fly that actually would attack the Japanese beetle in Japan. Because in Japan, they don't really have a problem with this beetle. It's around, but its natural predators kind of keep it under wraps, keep it under control. They brought this fly here, they released it throughout New England, and they've been waiting ever since. Well, there's some good news. It looks like it's actually starting to take hold. There are some signs in some places that they've found Japanese beetle adults that have been parasitized. About 20% of their population has been parasitized by this fly. What you look for if you want to see, you know, your Japanese beetles and see the fly itself and its damage that it's doing, is when you look for the beetles, look for some white spots on its thorax. Those are the eggs of this fly. If you see beetles with white spots on its back or its thorax, leave it, because they're going to hatch into little worms that tunnel into the adult beetle and basically eat it from the inside out. It's like a horror movie, I know.
So it would be humane to kill the beetle now, then.
It would be, but you don't want to, because you want it to reproduce and send out more flies to kill more of the beetles. The only downside, and reason it's taken almost 100 years for it to get established here, is that the life cycles don't really match very well. The beetle comes out and the fly is not there, or the fly is not there and the beetle's not there. So there are some things a gardener can do to enhance this native population of the winsome fly. That's what it's called, the winsome fly. I love that. And that's to grow these umbelliferous plants that I was mentioning earlier. Things like the Queen Anne's lace or yarrow or those dill and fennel. They like those, and they will come to those for nectar. And while they're there, hey, let's have some Japanese beetles for snacks too. So something you can do in the garden. You're not going to see this kind of overrun the Japanese beetle population. You're still going to have to deal with it. But it is a positive thing that started to happen throughout New England where the population is starting to get infected by this fly.
All right. So there's the good news.
That's the good news.
Okay.
That's good news, bad news.
Alexander says, last week, Charlie gave an incredible presentation for the Southern Vermont Young Professionals that revolved around gardening for renters and container gardening. Can you share a few tidbits from that presentation? It was awesome.
It was fun. It was kind of a new presentation I put together because these Southern Vermont Young Professionals tend to be young people who are renting and don't have a lot of space, and they often will have to move every year or two wherever to a new rental. Maybe they buy a house, whatever. So I put together a presentation about what do you think about when you're doing that and what kind of equipment do you need, what kind of plants. And I really tried to emphasize what I call the tough and hard to kill plants. So everything from the house plants like the snake plant or the ZZ plant, which is really hard to kill, all the way up till your daylilies, your hostas, the bee bombs, your rudbeckias, the plants that can be dug up multiple times over a few years, and you can move them around and they'll still survive. So we talked a lot about that, container gardening, vertical gardening, gardening on decks and patios, gardening in small spaces, raised beds that are portable raised beds where you can just pull them up when you're leaving and take them with you. So it was fun. It was a good group of people, and we had a lot of fun talking about that.
I was wandering around Boston and Cambridge this past weekend and saw a lot of gardens that were either just, you know, right in the front between the house and the sidewalk, mm-hmm. or, window beds that were herb gardens. I mean, they were beautiful, but also
yes.
You clearly being used as edible gardens. And
yes.
I mean, that seems like a good way to be able
and it's good to do that. And I actually just came from a veterans garden we're doing at the Cots homeless shelter in Winooski, and we're putting in a bunch of gardens right along the sidewalk. The big thing that they alerted me to that a lot of people have to realize is that people walk their dogs along the walk, so they sometimes do their business kind of on the side. So you just have to be aware of that, and maybe a raised bed where the animal will be less likely to pee on it or something might be a better idea.
Or clean your veggies.
Definitely clean your veggies.
Okay.
In either case.
All right. So one last question here. We talked about mulch and stone mulch earlier in the show, and mm-hmm. Randall in South Burlington just wants to know, do you put fabric under stone mulch? Do you use a particular size like pea stone or river stone? And how deep do you layer the stone
yes.
mulch?
Yes. So you want to use landscape fabric underneath it. You want to keep a nice layer. Oh, it could be the thicker the better because it'll take more energy for the seed to germinate and take hold. But I'd say a good 6 inches or so of mulch. You can use small pea-sized mulch. It's really nice. It's really more of a decorative thing at that point, or some larger rocks if you want to have that look. The pea size looks kind of smoother and nicer in the garden.
Charlie Nardozzi is a gardening expert and host of the Vermont Garden Journal on VPR. He's also a consultant. He can come to your house and help you out if you want. And if you just can't get enough Charlie, you can go on a trip with him, right?
Come with me to England and Wales. July 9th to the 19th, I'm leading a garden tour. We're going to see some of the great gardens of England and Wales. You know Wales very well.
Yes, I do.
And Northern Wales. And we're going to Downton Abbey. Highclere Manor, and we'll get a private tea with the owner of the house and see the gardens there too. So there's a few spaces still available, July 9th and 19th.
We have a link to Charlie's website on today's Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. You can find out all the information about that trip as well as everything else that Charlie does. Charlie, always a pleasure. Thanks for being here today.
It's great to be here, Jane.
Tomorrow, we'll be joined by not a gardening expert. We'll be joined by a political expert, Senator Patrick Leahy. We'll talk about the Supreme Court, the presidential race, the senator's push on criminal justice reform, and more. And you can send your questions or comments for him to vermontedition@vpr.net. And be sure to listen tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.